You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Religion. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. I just had a really interesting conversation with Peter Gottschalk about his book, Religion, Science, and Empire, Classifying Hinduism and Islam in British India, which was published with Oxford University Press in 2012. When did religion begin in South Asia? Many would argue that it was not until the colonial encounter that South Asians began to understand themselves as religious. In this great new book, Gottschalk outlines the contingent and mutual coalescence of science and religion as they were cultivated within the structures of empire. He demonstrates how the categories of Hindu and Muslim were constructed and applied to the residents of the chain-poor nexus of villages by the British, despite the fact that these identities were not always how South Asians describe themselves. Throughout this study, we are made aware of the consequences of comparison and classification in the study of religion. Gottschalk engages Jonathan Z. Smith's modes of comparison, demonstrating that seemingly neutral categories serve ideological purposes, and forms of knowledge are not arbitrary in order. Here we observe this work through imperial forms of knowledge production in South Asia, including the roles of cartographers, statisticians, artists, ethnographers, and photographers. In the end, we witness the social consequences of British scientism and its effects on the construction of the category religion in South Asia. In our conversation, we discuss map-making, travel writing, Christian theology, the authority of positioning, the census, folklore studies, ethnographies, royal societies, museums, indigenous identifications, and theories for the study of religion. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Peter Gottschalk. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.
Welcome again to New Books in Religion. Today I'm speaking with Peter Gottschalk about his great new book, Religion, Science, and Empire, Classifying Hinduism and Islam in British India. This is a really wonderful book that's covering a lot of information. We probably won't get to talk about everything, but I think that everyone working in the history of religions will surely benefit from this. So thank you for writing a wonderful book. Peter, how are you?
Just fine, Christian. How are you?
I'm great. Before we get into the details of your data here, usually what we begin with is kind of how you got interested in the study of religion, perhaps influential mentors you had that either reflect your topic that you study or the approach that you take. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up working in this field?
Well, I really wasn't interested in the study of religion per se, certainly in terms of South Asia, during my undergraduate work at all. We had no South Asian studies available at my college, and except for one course, and I didn't take it. But we did have a scholar of Islam, John Esposito, And I did audit a course of his. I didn't even take it for full credit. But it was influential in part because I ended up visiting my parents who were working in Saudi Arabia at the time, right after taking that class. And that was actually the impetus for my taking that class. And not long after that, I was in India for 6 months on my first visit. And so some of those experiences and the background of John's course really had an impact on me. But not enough to make me think that I was going to study religion when I decided to enter grad school. I entered grad school with the idea of studying history, and specifically the history of cultural contact. I was raised during the Cold War when it seemed as though social and cultural misunderstandings were contributing certainly to some of the misunderstandings that might lead to actual all-out war. And so I was interested in bringing to American students and American readers some insight in how cultural conflict might have occurred in the past and how that might be relevant for how it might occur in the present. So I decided that British Empire seemed like a good avenue to pursue this, given the fact that they were making cultural contacts and impacts all across the globe. And by happenstance, decided that India seemed like an interesting place to explore that. So when I entered grad school for my master's degree, I was actually a history program. But I soon changed to religion because I realized that to pursue some of these issues of cultural misunderstanding, that religion, not always, but often served as a quick avenue into some of those misunderstandings. And frankly, by that time, my interest had really been sharpened in terms of the study of religion.
Now, this book, it relates to your larger body of work. You've written a lot, and it's interesting kind of hearing your background. You can kind of see perhaps some of the motivations that drove you to your subjects. Could you talk a little bit about how this book began to emerge as a book? When did you think of it as a book project? And perhaps also, how does it relate to your earlier work?
Well, I had initially done my dissertation work using ethnographic research in Chainpur, the village in Bihar, which is at the heart of this book. And I made that into my first monograph. And really enjoyed that work and wanted to continue my contact with the people of Chainpur and try to understand more about their lives and their social, religious, and political circumstances. It happened for personal reasons that I found myself in Cambridge, England for a summer. I made an opportunity to go down to British Library whenever I could to see if I could find any historical materials about Chainpur. And it turned out that there was quite a bit more than I could have ever guessed. And so that led to a question of why would there be so much material about this one village in Bihar? And secondly, at the same time, because of my contacts at working in a small liberal arts college at the time, I became really fascinated by issues of science and what I think is important to call scientism, which is the kind of hegemony of science, the authority that science seems to have in American society and many other societies. And so I realized as I was finding these materials in the British Library about Chainpur that many of them were really ensconced within a scientific framework that seemed to lend it authority in the eyes of some of their readers because of that scientific framework.
Now, within the book, you also are talking specifically to different audiences, and you're very conscious about this, and you make this explicit. I'm wondering if you could talk about what you're trying to do or what you're trying to achieve with these different audiences. Talk a little bit about if this was difficult in trying to reach everyone in a single monograph. And perhaps one of the things that I think is unique about your book in terms of structure is you have what you call theoretical interludes. And I think this is, I'm guessing, probably related to these kind of audiences you're trying to reach. So could you talk about kind of the writing the book, how you structured it, the people you're trying to reach?
Yeah, I think in terms of audiences, there are the two matrices of audiences that I was interested in getting to. First were upper-level college students and grad students who might find this book to be helpful in terms of their studies, in terms of their introduction to the study of religion in South Asia. The book is intended to try to create a larger context for understanding how the study of religion coalesced in South Asia under the British rule, without focusing on the armchair scholars who wrote the books that tend to get the most attention, as well as the Orientalists who also get much more attention than some of the mid-level officers and folks on the ground, as well as the Indians who were writing about Chainpur and who never had a position at Oxford or never were major players in the British administration. Another set of audiences would be my colleagues in the study of religion in South Asia, because I was thinking of them as I wrote this book. As I was getting into the research, I realized that historians of South Asia write in a somewhat of a closed universe. They use terminology and they have understandings about revenue surveys and about other aspects of the administration that don't get well explained in their scholarship, because they're writing to one another. And when they write to general audiences or to college student audiences, these elements kind of fall out. So I wanted to write description of the ways in which Chainpur was being described and thereby many other rural locations were being described by British administrators, whether they're British or Indian, and the ways in which those descriptions fit a larger apparatus of intelligence gathering and knowledge formation that many of my colleagues, I suspected, would not understand completely. So that was one set of audiences. Another set of audiences to whom I tried to address the book were folks from different disciplines. So my first audience were scholars of religion, and I was seeking to try to, as I said, explain how the study of religion, as an academic discipline, really only coalesced in the 19th century, how it coalesced within the context of imperialism. And this is just one small example, obviously, with this focus on a village. I thought to also appeal to scholars who are historians of South Asia to bring attention to the centrality of religion in many of these British descriptions, and Indian rather descriptions also, of rural areas like Chainpur. This has been an ongoing debate in much of the scholarship, but not much of the scholarship has focused on the ground level as I was trying to do. So those were another set of audiences I was trying to address.
And with the theoretical interludes, how did those come about, or how did you think of those in the structure of the book?
The idea behind the theoretical interludes was to try to take the issues of imperial episteme and put it onto a larger frame. So a great deal of imperial and colonial studies focuses, of course, on various asymmetries of power and the like. But what I found, especially by considering the work of Peter van der Veer and the few other scholars who take the study of British engagements with South Asia and put them in the same context as British engagements with Britons, that is to do a comparative study of the ways in which Britons understood not only South Asians, but also themselves, and find some points of commonality as well as difference, then I thought it was important to then offer a theoretical framework in which comparison could be understood more generally. And hence, as the reader was thinking about these engagements that I was describing, they could think about the larger theoretical background of how comparison works for anyone. And when they walked away from the book, hopefully they would have a tool that would be useful in engaging in materials that might be also interesting to them.
Yeah, I think they're really successful too, in the sense of, you know, if you are teaching a course and you don't have space to include your whole book, they would be great examples to introduce these types of thinking and issues of classification and comparison to undergraduates. So I think anyone could really use those in their courses.
And in fact, the idea of using them comes out of my own teaching, because it's heavily borrowed from the work of Jonathan Z. Smith, and I use Smith's work in my teaching all the time in order to evoke exactly this kind of thinking among my students.
Yeah, I really like that in the book. I think it's a successful method or strategy that I hope others will follow. Could you talk a little bit about Chainpur, the nexus of villages that make up this area? Both, you know, what might somebody who's not familiar with South Asia need to know to understand kind of the broader context of what you're writing about, but also what makes this a successful example of thinking this? You kind of mentioned the dearth of materials, but other than that, why Chainpur?
So Chainpur is a fascinating place to study for a number of different reasons. In some ways, it might seem counterintuitive because it's not Bengal, and Bengal has had more than the lion's share of scholarship about British South Asia. It's not Uttar Pradesh, which represented a later stage in British conquest and rule, and of course has Delhi and Agra as former imperial centers, which makes it also very interesting, as well as Awadh. Bihar, in a great deal of scholarship, whether it's historical or contemporary, often gets overlooked, in part because it's a place that a lot of non-Indian and even Indian scholars don't prefer to go because it is perceived to be such a poor and violent place because of the casteism, the Naxalites, and for some other reasons as well. And so it's been unfortunately quite overlooked in a great deal of scholarship, although there are some scholars who have made real efforts in that direction. So as a result of that, there's a great deal of fascinating work to be done in Bihar that just hasn't happened so far. So Bihar offers a great deal of fascinating materials with which to work, and Chainpur is an amazing place to study because of the fact that it is a village, but it's on the large side of a village. It actually would count as a town according to the Indian census, but people routinely refer to it as gaon, as village. So it has a village sensibility, and at the same time, it has a variety of historical and social markers that make it very prominent in the region. And for a variety of different reasons, various British and Indian authors, painters, administrators, officers took note of Chainpur. So it provides a place that has not been studied very well, that has a great deal of British era material committed to it, various representations, and that has not gained the attention of a great deal of published work since independence. Hmm.
Extending from the sources, there's a lot about South Asian religions and early representations in the formation of the history of religion as a discipline from Western intellectuals, and you expressly say that these individuals, people like Weber and Mueller, were reliant on the cartographers and the statisticians and the artists and the travelers. So could you talk a little bit about these lower level individuals you've mentioned already? What did their observations What role did they play in the construction of religion in South Asia? And then how does that inform or shape our kind of broader history of religions in South Asia?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what often happened was that, let's just talk about a British Indian administrative level. You would have officers and other civil servants who were responsible for local issues, and they would make certain reports and make maps and do other sorts of representations, which would then be sent to their superiors. So their superiors would have a bit of a sense of what's happening regionally, which would be sent up to their superiors, which would allow them to have an understanding of what's happening provincially, which then would be sent to their superiors, which would allow them to understand what was happening in British India in general. So there are those levels that are important to recognize. And then there are the civilians who came through and who made their own depictions as well. So, for instance, the Daniels, Thomas and William Daniel, an uncle-nephew painting team came through in the late 18th century. They were interested in just making a career of their painting, and they thought that India was an opportunity for them. And they just happened to stop in Chainpur. It didn't just happen. Actually, they went out of their way to go to Chainpur for reasons that aren't entirely clear, although we might guess. And so they also leave their representations. Now, in terms of the representations of the administrators, some of these reports that they created and some of the images that they made sometimes found their ways, quoted verbatim, into reports of their superiors. Some of these officers in their own career trajectory became superiors, and some of them published their work either through the government or outside of the government. So they truly became administrator-scholars in their careers. And some of those works became quite influential for the British public, but also for the emerging Indian public as well. And there's that can't be underestimated. Another way in which they became influential was that as more Indians participated in the British Indian government, they also took in these reports. They also were influenced by their perspectives and the inherited expectations and understandings that came with government service. And after independence, many of these civil servants' works continue to be influential. So, for instance, Francis Buchanan, who did the first comprehensive foot survey of Bihar and Bengal for the British in the early 19th century, he's mentioned in the Archaeological Survey of India. He's mentioned in the Census of India and in a number of other websites for current Indian government departments, because he's seen to be the father, and that's often the language that's used, for their particular discipline in the government. So these folks had a variety of different types of impacts, and the Daniels actually had a profound impact because the images they created of South Asia became the most influential visual images, arguably, for the entirety of the British Empire. And they found those images found their way not only into galleries, but also onto china, onto tiles that were put into people's homes. And they were reproduced in all sorts of different ways.
Now, this nexus of religion, science, and empire that you highlight in the title, you say, I'm going to read a brief quote. You say, "We cannot know the notions of religion and science without considering the mutually imbricated histories of their codependent coalescence." So can you help us start to unpack this? You're not really talking about science here, but what you call scientism. So perhaps we can start there. What do you mean by scientism versus science, perhaps? How did it inform imperial projects and authority? And ultimately, what does this have to do with religion? How do we end up with religion through these projects?
Sure. Actually, if I could, I'll just flip the order a little bit. Let me just talk about science and religion, and then we'll get to scientism. So, unfortunately, there's a common expectation, not only in the public, but also among many scholars, that religion and science are necessarily oppositional and foe-like, and that the rise of empirical science in the 18th and 19th centuries with the Enlightenment necessarily came with a diminution of religion as rationality increasingly spread its rosy fingers of dawn over the landscape, the intellectual landscape of Europe and ultimately the world. And that narrative, that master narrative, overlooks a variety of really important dynamics that shouldn't be overlooked. So for the first thing, it overlooks the way in which the development of what Europeans called science was deeply imbricated in the history of European imperialism and colonialism in ways that can't be underestimated. The intellectual labor and the physical labor that many colonized, imperially dominated people provided to scientific projects has often been overlooked. And the necessity of having imperial domains in foreign places in order to do certain types of scientific projects has also been too often overlooked. It's also important to recognize that what we understand today as religion, the way we understand that term, developed in many ways in a mutually interconnected conversation, not only with secularism, as many scholars have pointed out, but also with notions of science, the notion that somehow religion was irrational as opposed to the rationality of science is something of a product of this period. So when the British came to South Asia, there was some sense, there had to be an appreciation for what they understood as the civilizations of South Asia and the creation of the Taj Mahal and other examples of great culture. But at the same time, they needed to have an understanding of why that would legitimate and justify British rule. And part of it was the sense that Hindus and Muslims were irreparably against one another because of their firm inrootedness in the irrationality of religion. So not all Britons thought of things this way, but many did. And that's one reason why religion figured so prominently in British imaginations from the very beginning of their epistemic projects. So while all of this is happening, there is this rising notion of scientism. Scientism refers to, as I suggested before, the authority of the set of disciplines associated with the term science, the authority that those disciplines have in society, a hegemonic authority which goes largely unquestioned, that these forms of knowledge are the truest way of understanding the human and natural worlds. And so religion then becomes something that is not an avenue for that those efforts of understanding, and in fact is often seen to be oppositional to understanding the world. And then we have narratives of medieval European Catholicism and the victims of the Catholic Church, like Galileo and the like, that help to affirm that portrayal. So that's where the intersections of religion, science, and empire come from that are related to that are mentioned in the title.
Yeah. Now, for listeners, just so they can kind of follow along, what you do through the most of the remainder of the book is look at the development of specific disciplines and systems of knowledge, such as cartography, ethnography, anthropology, and some others. You begin with cartography, and I believe you kind of follow a chronological approach. Could you talk a little bit about the differences between British imperial cartography
You compare this with Mughal cartography, and specifically how were maps used to mark religious identities?
Yeah, the idea behind the structure of the chapters was to demonstrate to audiences the way that the disciplines that we take so for granted in the academy were actually forming in the late 18th and mostly in the 19th century, and that they were forming not as some sort of natural expression of the development of knowledge, but in part through the needs of imperial projects. So cartography, which has been described by some as the queen of all sciences, because it seems to provide this, as it were, God's eye view of the earth that seems to be so transparently true, although we may all have problems with our Google Maps apps on our smartphones. Nevertheless, the fact that we are so bothered and so surprised that we would have problems with that perhaps suggests the ways in which so many people have an inherent faith, if I can use the term, in cartographic knowledge. And indeed, the development of Google Earth and the ability to telescope in and out of various landscape scenes from above is a nice expression. It's kind of the culmination of this faith in cartography, which is one of the first beginnings of the development of scientism in some ways. And so the use of cartography in British India was very often tied to the various other endeavors, because cartography often served as the way of expressing various concerns that came up in British imperial endeavors. So, for instance, if there was a census of India, perhaps, then maps might be created in order to project, as it were, the results of the census onto this cartographical space. And by choosing a particular frame for that space, this is something that Edney brings out in his Mapping Empire book, by choosing a particular frame, one creates a kind of iconic view of what British India is, and hence what eventually Indian nationalists will claim India is. And so the map becomes a very important projection screen for people's understandings. And onto that are going to be projected various understandings of religion. So one of the examples, a very, very prosaic example, is of a mid-19th century revenue map that was created for the sake of trying to describe the borders of Chainpur so that the revenue collectors could do a better job of things, because every village in Bihar was meant to be mapped in this way. But these maps, these revenue maps, weren't just of the borders, interestingly enough. They were also of various other types of social information, which were plotted onto the map. And one of the things, one of the topics that is plotted onto this particular map is of the mosques and temples of Chainpur. And the question would be, why mark these elements? There isn't any evidence that they're being marked for revenue purposes, but they simply represent some sort of social fact, which the revenue collectors and their mappers under their employ consider to be important. And it's not just the Chainpur revenue map that shows this, but all the revenue maps for all of the villages around Chainpur show it as well. And why that particular element says something to us in the 21st century is the fact that the dargahs, or the Sufi tombs that are also marked on the map, that they are not marked as dargahs, even though anybody on the ground would have easily identified it as such, but rather they're marked as mosques. So they are fitted into a binary of Hindu-Muslim. And in fact, dargahs are very important spaces of Hindu-Muslim religious interaction on a daily scale that, again, is entirely well known to folks on the ground, but nevertheless don't make it onto the map. And so the map, this particular map, demonstrates nicely to us the way that British Indian administrators were caught in this binary of Hindu-Muslim as mutually exclusive categories. Okay, and so that's one other element that's so important for scientism, is that it's more than just expressing the authority of science, but it's also the appropriation of certain scientific notions and absorbing them into society in a broader way. And one of the scientific notions that we find in scientific taxonomies from European models is that all taxons, that is, all classifications, have to be mutually exclusive. So a platypus, for instance, cannot be a mammal and a aquatic animal, a fish, at the same time, even though it lives in the water and even though it has fur. So it seems as though it would fit both classes. It's not allowed to fit both classes. And so zoologists struggled for some decades to figure out how to fit a platypus into a category because it didn't fit the scientific categories and it wasn't allowed to fit in between two categories or to two categories simultaneously. And so this map demonstrates nicely how a darga was not allowed to be both Hindu and Muslim. It had to be either Hindu or Muslim.
Yeah. Now, the next two chapters, you focus on travelogues, and you look at both what you call Christocentric travel writing and then humanist travel writing. Can you talk about ways of representation that come through in this and the different purposes between kind of pseudo-theological accounts and humanist accounts and how religion gets played out in these differences?
Yeah, the key point that I was trying to bring out there in making that distinction is that the basis of the comparison, and that's something that J.Z. Smith draws our attention to, is what is the basis of our comparisons? What is the interest that underlies the comparison? And what is the key of interpretation that's used to make sense of the difference that's being drawn out? That for Christocentric travel writers, they're starting from a certain type of Christian theology that establishes a certain difference between those who are Christians and those who are not. Whereas the humanist travel writers don't necessarily start with that perspective, and might find other reasons for comparison, other reasons for difference than that theological one.
What do these accounts look like, and how do they differ in their content, in their explanation and representation of South Asia?
Well, one of the elements that I bring out in the theoretical interlude is an attention to categories and the way in which categories are formed and the hierarchies that may or may not be included in those categories. So for many of the Christological travelogue writers, categories are often based on a theological premise, which is those, for instance, a kind of a larger distinction between those who believe in Jesus and those who don't. So Hindus immediately fall into the those who don't category, but Muslims fall into those who do category. And then that category gets distinguished between those who believe in Jesus as Messiah and those who do not. So Muslims fall into the those who do not category in that case, and Christians into those who do. And then there can be often a ranking as to which are higher or lower of those three categories. And so you can see the ways in which the theological key of interpretation and of comparison is playing such an important role there. There are some who ultimately don't see it as necessarily hierarchical and have a very pluralistic theological perspective, with the sense that all religions are necessarily approaching God from their own direction, and none are better or worse than others. But that is hard to find examples of travel writers, Christological travel writers who have that perspective. Among the humanist travel writers, there are a variety of different kind of categories and comparisons that can be drawn out. And because it's not as tied to a theological perspective, religion may or may not be very central into their notions of comparison. And with the very basic understanding that starting with a common ground of humanity, that also plays a very important role in demonstrating a different sort of comparison among the humanist travel writers.
One of the other things that arises in these accounts is this, the notion of authority or authenticity from being on what you say on the spot. Can you talk a little bit about the role of being there and how that kind of asserts authority for the person making the representations?
Yeah, so that's another important element that particularly feeds into the humanist travelogues as well. This, what David Arnold calls an ocular authority. Foucault also talks about this. The power of, or rather the authority of having been on the spot, of having seen it for yourself. So we find that in medieval Europe, for instance, the authority was often reserved for various sources that could track themselves back to traditions, particularly traditions of the church, and an authority associated with certain institutions and certain types of learning. In this case, that doesn't entirely disappear, but that authority can actually be undermined by empirical observation that seems to challenge the findings or the conclusions of various authorities. So the Daniels, the uncle, nephew, travel, the artist team that I mentioned earlier, they demonstrated this really nicely. They are travelers. Their images are meant to depict their travels. And they are following in the footsteps of another travel artist by the name of William Hodges, who actually had been an artist aboard two of Captain Cook's voyages. So he had a certain type of authority because of that. But they were very critical of him because even though both sets of artists were following the trope of the picturesque in their artistry, that is following certain notions of how to construct a landscape scene and an allowance to exaggerate certain things in order to make it more attractive to the viewer. So even though both sets of artists were following this notion of the picturesque, the Daniels are more infused with the notion of the on the spot, with the quote unquote accurate representation of what they are portraying. And so we have the journal of the younger of the two, Daniels, and he's constantly critical of Hodges because he thinks that he doesn't do accurate presentations. And so he's constantly saying, oh, we went to this site and Uncle and I drew these images that are much more accurate than what Hodges had to offer. So you can see in just a change in a decade or so between Hodges and the Daniels that there's a slowly galvanizing grip of the empirical on these representations and the authority of the on the spot in these presentations.
Now you've alluded to the taxonomical ideals of natural science and how they inform British systems of classification a little bit already. You focus on this in one chapter within issues of the census and statistics of local peoples. Can you tell us a little bit about how these senses formed identities, what identities were available to people responding to these, perhaps how these categories changed over time.
Right. As per your previous question, that indeed there were some of these forms of knowledge existed before the British came under the Mughals and under others, and a census or at least a count of people was certainly something that existed under previous regimes. But what differs with the British, which is nothing that was seen at all in pre-British South Asia, was that the British sought in 1872 to count every single individual Indian on one night. And that effort to count everyone, no matter what their caste, no matter what their religion, no matter what their gender or their education status or their location, was absolutely unique. They weren't successful in doing it in one night, but by 1881, they were able to do it in one night. And of course, the census then, as now in India and in the United States, relies on a set of questions that the enumerators ask the occupants of the house. And those questions are predetermined. And the answers are not. It's important to recognize that one of the few questions that were asked in 1872 and that were asked throughout the entirety of the British Empire was, what is your religion? And that question was asked of every member of the house. And anybody could answer any way that they liked. So you could say Muslim, you could say Hindu or Christian or Sikh, or I don't know, or I don't have one. And that would be recorded. Some people, for instance, said Muslim Brahmin, and that was recorded. So that would suggest a real pluralism. But what happened when these slips of paper on which all this information was recorded was then tabulated and aggregated back in the district offices so that the numbers could be crunched and sent on up the line administratively, was that there was no pigeonhole. And that's literally what they put these slips of paper into, pigeonholes. There was no pigeonhole for Muslim Brahmin. There was simply a pigeonhole for Hindu Brahmin or for Muslim. And so the pluralism that was obvious in the recording was not obvious in the tabulation, because the tabulation relied on these mutually exclusive categories. You couldn't count in more than one category. Just as in the United States, there was no ability for somebody, when answering the race question, somebody like Barack Obama, to say that they were both black and white. That was not possible. You had to choose one or the other. That was the case in the United States until 2000. That was the case throughout the British Empire, that you were going to be counted only in one category or the other. Now, as the empire went on, and as Indians became interested in participating in the democracy that the British seemed to hold out as a hope for the future, the need, of course, was to find constituencies, because democratic politics relies on identifying and speaking to certain constituencies and addressing their interests. And so the idea of finding religiously based constituencies, in part based on census data that suggested where various religious communities were most densely situated, and also based in part on this notion that religious identity was central to the identity of most Indians, which was perpetrated by British writers as well as some Indian ones, meant that as Indian democratic politics began to form, there was a strong religious element to that. And we actually have various Indian groups fighting to get included in certain categories and excluded from others. So, for instance, the Hindu Mahasabha made a variety of petitions to the British government in the 1930s that Sikhs and Jains should be included as Hindus in the counts of the All India counts of religion. Meanwhile, you had some Sikh and Jain groups resisting that and demanding to have their own categories. And that level of engagement of South Asians in the census project, in the scientific taxonomical project of the census, demonstrates well how the effort to resist British hegemony led many South Asians to actually participate in the epistemic hegemony that the British had laid the groundwork for.
You move on in the next chapter. You title it "A Raja, a Ghost, and a Tribe." Almost sounds like the start of a joke. But can you tell us how local narratives were used to explain difference?
Well, in a variety of ways. And so what that chapter is trying to demonstrate is how both ethnology and folklore studies were beginning to coalesce in the late 19th century. And particularly in folklore studies, a very interesting impetus was gathering force to pay attention to the local and to understand these narratives in their own terms, and to not force them actually into quite necessarily into fitting into the previous categories as some of the previous disciplines had forced. And so this narrative of the dead Brahm, the ghost of a Brahmin who exacts a vengeance on the local Raja, which is a very important narrative today in Chainpur, we find being repeatedly recorded from the 19th century onward by visitors to Chainpur who are interested in these matters and in the past. And we have folks like William Crook, who reported that narrative in a couple of his publications as part of an effort to demonstrate the varieties of perspectives about the past and about religion on the ground. And Crook's an interesting figure because he worked very closely with an Indian interlocutor who provided quite a bit of intellectual capital to these endeavors. Crook had his own blind spots, but he was very interested in avoiding the kind of grand claims that were made. And his comparative project culminates in a two-volume set about North Indian folklore and religion, which really provides almost an encyclopedic comparative approach in which he breaks down various types of stories that say about the living dead and suggests various types of themes that get drawn out without any type of comparing them in any kind of hierarchical way as being better or worse or more superstitious or more true or anything like that. He represents an interesting development in this British episteme.
The final discipline you look at is archaeology, and you look at the role of institutions. So things like the Archaeological Survey of India, the Royal Society, the Asiatic Society, the Indian Museum. How did the development of institutions facilitate the promotion of scientific discovery and preserve these religious identities that they classified in particular ways?
Yeah, the development of these institutions is another incredibly interesting element and dimension of these forces I'm trying to describe. Because many of these institutions were formed on a voluntary basis by British administrators who had the study of various elements of Indian religion and culture as part of their hobby. It certainly could have some fairly negative effects, but it's interesting that how many of them set their minds to these endeavors. And as part of those endeavors, they often formed communities such as the Asiatic Society of Bengal, right, which is one of the oldest example of one of these learned societies. And these learned societies very much parallel what's happening back in the metropole. So you have the Royal Society as a model for many of these societies, but there are new societies that are being formed in London and other places, in England as well as other parts of Europe at the same time. So it's also important to recognize the ways in which many Indians contributed to these societies as well. So, for instance, the Indian Museum is an interesting example. Although there were no Indians on the administering board when the Asiatic Society of Bengal came up with the idea for the Indian Museum, Indians would contribute very importantly to the ASB and would also have a hand in the Indian Museum. So, but that those endeavors are never entirely, well, those endeavors have often important connections to the government. So many of the people involved with them are actually government employees. The only reason they are in India, if they're not Indian themselves, is because they're in the employee of the British Indian government. But also the Indian Museum, for instance, came about because members of the Asiatic Society of Bengal decided that they would like to donate their collections. So the collections that they personally were developing as part of their own hobbies, they wanted to donate those to the government only with the expectation that the government would establish a museum. And they didn't want to call the Indian Museum. They protested when the government said that that was going to be the name. But that was the name that the government insisted upon. And so there it was. So these institutions play their own role. They play their own role in helping to promote certain forms of knowledge, to make them more popular. Many of these learned societies also have global connections. So they are sharing their reports across the globe. Also, when the Census of India, for instance, and the Archaeological Survey of India, when they publish certain results, they often send copies to these institutions, both in India and outside India. And so there is really a global circuit for the circulation of this knowledge that has developed in this globalized world that the British Empire helped to bring to existence.
You wrap the book up on a contemporary reflection. You look at Jainpur today, and I wonder if you could tell us what some of the social consequences of British scientism and specifically the construction of the category of religion within Jainpur society.
So there is a very robust set of knowledges that exist in Jainpur today, and some of them are not at all connected to that British-originated episteme, but others are, and particularly those that we find that are perpetrated in the school system. There are a rising number of private schools and a better quality government schools in Jainpur today, and they very often take these basic elements of the scientistic way of understanding the world and propagate it in a variety of different ways. Biology, chemistry, mathematics are just some of the disciplines that are taught in Jainpur schools in ways that are closely approximate what was developed during British India and are quite distinct from what existed before the British Empire. In terms of some of the expectations about religion and the like, there are ways in which those are also communicated. There is, in very interestingly, often an oversight of local examples in which some of these differences in religious categories don't necessarily work, such as the continuing functionality of the Sufi tombs and the ways in which Hindus and Muslims pray there. The school's approach to religion often doesn't pay much attention to that. Not that there's a lot of attention usually on that particular theme, but we do find that the sciences are taught in a fairly uncritical manner and accepted for how they are.
Now, for students of religion, I think one of the big points or ways of thinking about this book is this idea of the various modes of a comparison and then how this affects our categories. So I wonder if you could kind of just think about how each of these chapters kind of expresses one of these modes. I don't know if you did this on purpose or if this was kind of a later realization, but you follow J.Z. Smith's categorical system from In Comparison of Magic Dwells very closely. Was that an afterthought, or did you realize that, or was that a kind of a structuring model as you went into this project? But how does your data kind of, reflect or substantiate what J.Z. Smith is talking about in this issue of classification?
Yeah, I think J.Z. Smith's notions work out fairly well in what I'm showing, the notion of differences between statistical comparison, encyclopedic comparison, ethnographic. Help to understand how these different representations create different types of comparisons. Not only, although the categories might be the same, the way that they relate to one another can be very different. And so it works out fairly well in trying to understand the mechanics of the differences between these different forms. It also, I think, demonstrates well Jay-Z's point that there isn't one particular form of comparison that is immune from major problems. Each form of comparison is problematic, but at the same time, comparison is at the very heart of all forms of knowledge. And so we can't just sidestep the issue just because there isn't any ideal way of doing comparison. We have to recognize that it's at the heart of all knowledge. And so we have to understand how it's at the heart of the forms of knowledge that we're pursuing, and then also recognize how it necessarily suffers from certain disadvantages, no matter which choice we make. Mm.
Peter, excellent book, and thank you for all your efforts. You could really tell reading through this that it was a tremendous effort. But before we let you go, I'm sure listeners would be very eager to hear what kind of things you're working on now, what projects you might have coming out in the future.
Well, this track of studies of Chanpur, as it were, and of religious identity in South Asia has always been my main track of my scholarship. But I've also had another track, which is on Islamophobia in the United States. And so what I'd like to do is actually marry those two tracks together to bring together something about Islamophobia and anti-Muslim sentiment within the British empirical system. And the contours of that I'm still working out, but a sabbatical coming up this semester should help me, give me some time to think about it.
Great. That sounds wonderful, too. So good luck, and perhaps you can come back and talk about that project.
Well, that would be great. Thank you so much for your interest in this one.
Yeah, thanks again, Peter.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Peter Gottschalk about his book Religion, Science, and Empire, Classifying Hinduism and Islam in British India, published with Oxford.